afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you'd like to be on the program, that's what we're here for, is for you to be on the program. If you have a question from the Bible or a question about Christianity or a question about any related topic, if you're not a Christian, want to talk about your religious views vis-a-vis my own Christian views, you're welcome to do that if you'd like. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And we have only one line open at the moment, but if you call quickly, you can get it. I want to just say to our Orange County listeners, and I don't know that we have a lot of Orange County listeners for the simple reason that we're not on the radio in Orange County. That's in Southern California. We don't have a radio station in Orange County, but we do have listeners who listen on the Internet there, as we do in many, many places where we don't have a radio station. And so from time to time, I hold a gathering in Orange County. Of course, my family, my parents, my children, at least three of my five children, live in Southern California. So I come down, and we sometimes have meetings down here with those who do listen to the program. We're going to be doing that tomorrow. So if you're in Southern California, want to join us, you can do that. We meet at 4 o'clock whenever I'm down here on a Saturday. And we meet at 4 o'clock. We have an open Bible discussion followed by a meal, which is served, of course, for free. It's in a home. And you're welcome to call Don or Jennifer to get information about that gathering, for example, how to get there. If you want to come, if you're listening from or you're going to be tomorrow in Southern California and want to go, the meeting is in Lake Forest, California, which is right near Irvine. And if you want to call Don or Jennifer for directions, you can call them at this number. Area code 949-855-7821. That's area code 949-855-7821. And if you missed it, you can also get that from our website. And if you're listening on the Internet, you're probably at our website already. So on the announcements link, the website is thenarrowpath.com. Our lines are full right now, so we'll start talking to some of our callers. Our first one is Ben from Dexter, Oregon. Ben, good to hear from you again. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good, Steve. I had a question about Isaiah. I've been reading in Isaiah lately, and I got to the part about Emmanuel in chapter 7. And he just really reads like the whole virgin giving birth to this Emmanuel will be a short-term sign that Israel's enemies will be overthrown. But I know the New Testament kind of ascribes it to Christ, and so I'm kind of confused on those points. And then also in the next chapter, chapter 8, I'm also confused as to how it's being used, where Isaiah is just prophesying about things and then uses the Emmanuel name over and over in that chapter. You know what I'm talking about?
Of course, yes.
And what was that?
Yes, I do, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so if you could just share your thoughts on that, that really helped me out a lot.
Okay, well, Isaiah chapter 7 is a case where Isaiah is approaching King Ahaz, who is not a very good king, but he's the king of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is at that time being threatened by two armies, the armies of the northern kingdom called Israel, which is different than the kingdom of Judah that he rules over, and also the king of Assyria is confederate with Israel against him. And the plan of these two nations coming against him is to overthrow Ahaz and put a king on the throne who will be more compliant to their own agendas. And their agenda is to get a three-nation confederacy, Judah, Israel, and Syria, to resist the threats of the growing empire of Assyria that is coming to swallow up every little country around. Now, Ahaz, the king of Judah, is not interested in fighting against Assyria. I think he realizes that even the three nations together would be no match for it, so he's staying out of this. But the nation of Israel and the nation of Syria have decided to attack Judah and to replace Ahaz with a king, someone named the king of the son of Tabeel. We don't know anything else about him except that his name is mentioned there in chapter 7. And Ahaz is frightened because, actually, you know, he is being threatened by these two other nations. Now, Isaiah, actually, although the king is not a very good king, Isaiah is favorable. God is favorable toward Ahaz remaining aloof from this confederacy. And so Isaiah is sent to encourage King Ahaz in his resistance. And he comes to Ahaz and says, you know, the Lord says, you know, ask for a sign from me, and I'll give you a sign that, in other words, to encourage you. This is Isaiah 7. And Ahaz says, I will not ask for a sign. I'm not going to put the Lord to the test. And in verse 13, Isaiah says, well, O house of David, is it a little thing for you to weary men, but will you weary God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. And then it goes on and says, he shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. Now, it's clear that this is a short-term prophecy because he's talking to Ahaz about the two kings that are threatening him. And he says, this child is going to be born. And before this child is old enough to know the difference between right and wrong, these two kings that you're concerned about will be, will be gone. And in fact, they were. Within about 3.5 years, both of those kings, the king of Israel and the king of Syria, were basically taken into captivity killed by the Assyrians. So that this present threat was short-lived. And the way the sign was given was, this child is going to be born. And when you see this child is born, you'll know that before this child reaches even a few years old to know right from wrong, that, the birth of the child means that there's a very short time before your enemies are gone, is what basically it means. Now, you're right. There's some things about this that point to Jesus, not least the fact that it says the virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son. This is quoted by Matthew in Matthew chapter 1 as being about Jesus and the virgin birth. Also, the fact that he's called Emmanuel, which means the literal meaning of Emmanuel is God with us. And Matthew, when he quotes this verse, makes an issue about that. So he obviously applies it to Jesus. But there is a problem with that, because if we didn't have Matthew identifying this child as Jesus, we would certainly think, as we read through Isaiah, that chapter 8 tells us about the birth of the child predicted here. Because Isaiah himself fathers a child in chapter 8. And virtually the same thing is said about this child as is said about the child in chapter 7, verse 14. Because Isaiah is told to go into this woman and father a child. And he says in verse 3, I went into the prophetess. Most commentators assume she was his wife, of course. And she conceived and bore a son. Then the Lord said to me, call his name Maher Shalel Hashbaz, for before he knows how to cry, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away by the king of Assyria. Well, Damascus and Assyria are the capitals of the two nations threatening Ahaz. And so he's saying, this baby of Isaiah's, before he knows how to say mommy or daddy, these two kings will be gone. So in essence, that's the same prediction as chapter 7. There's going to be a baby born, and before that baby reaches more than a few years of age, those kings will be gone. And so the prediction is made twice, but once in Isaiah 7, 14, is about the virgin's child. In this case, it's Isaiah's own child. Furthermore, as Isaiah begins to prophesy to his own child, he talks about how the Assyrians will come against Judah, but not overflow it. And in Isaiah 8:8, he says to the child, it will sweep into Judah, it will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck and its outspread wings to fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Well, there's the name Emmanuel, and Isaiah is speaking to his own child by that name.
Right, so, and that's where I got to, and then I got lost after that.
Okay, so it's very clear that if somebody did not have the book of Matthew to direct him otherwise, somebody simply reading through the book of Isaiah would say, okay, chapter 7 predicts that there's going to be a child born, and before this child is out of his toddler years, these two kings that are threatening Ahaz will be gone, and he is called Emmanuel. Then we come to the next chapter, and we read that Isaiah becomes the father of a child, and the same prediction is made about this child, and this child is called Emmanuel. So you would, of course, assume this child is the one that was predicted. And you'd look for nothing more, probably. And then Matthew comes along and says, oh, no, but this is about Jesus. Now, the reason is because of the use of the word virgin here. Obviously, the reason Matthew quotes this verse in Isaiah 7:14 is because Matthew is telling us about the virgin birth. He tells us that Mary was a virgin and when she conceived, and he says, and that fulfilled this prophecy. So this prophecy gave, support to the idea of the Messiah born of a virgin. But the problem is, if you read the prophecy by itself in the Old Testament, you wouldn't even know that it was about the Messiah. But many people would say, well, wait a minute. The prophecy in Isaiah is about a virgin having a child, and Isaiah's wife was not a virgin. We're specifically told he went in and, they had relations and she conceived. So how could this be referred to as a virgin conceiving? Well, there's two ways that could go. One is that it's possible that the woman that Isaiah had the child by was a virgin at the time the prophecy was made, but that he married her and conceived this child through her shortly thereafter. So that when he said a virgin will conceive, he could mean a woman who is at this moment a virgin will conceive, but not necessarily while still being in the state of a virgin. And therefore, Isaiah's wife could be the woman referred to. But more importantly, I think, is the prophecy in Isaiah 7:14 does not say a virgin. It says the virgin. It says the virgin will conceive and bring forth a child. Now, that's an important consideration because it's speaking about the virgin as if they know who the virgin is, like there's some specific virgin in mind here. Now, who could that possibly be? Well, we do know that later on in the book of Isaiah, when Isaiah sends a message back to Sennacherib, who's taunting Hezekiah at the gates, Isaiah says to him, the virgin, the daughter of Zion, has mocked you, has laughed you to scorn. In other words, he's referring to Jerusalem as the virgin daughter of Zion. And for that reason, it's possible that when Isaiah said the virgin, rather than a virgin, but the virgin will conceive, he has a specific virgin in mind. The other reference I'm talking about is Isaiah 37, verse 22. This is in Isaiah 37, 22. The message that Isaiah says to send back to Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, he says, this is the word of the Lord that he's spoken concerning him. Here's the quote. She despises you. She scorns you. The virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you. The daughter of Jerusalem. So here we have Jerusalem symbolically referred to as the virgin. Now, if that's how Isaiah's words in chapter 7 were understood, the virgin will conceive and bring forth a child, it would simply be a poetic way of saying a child will be born in Jerusalem. The virgin Jerusalem will produce a child, as it were. Not magically or supernaturally, but through Isaiah and so forth. But the issue here would be that Matthew, guided by the Holy Spirit, because he was spiritually illuminated, saw that in addition to Isaiah's reference to the virgin, perhaps a reference to Jerusalem, that this had another fulfillment in the actual Virgin Mary, because Isaiah sees immediately that this idea of a virgin conceiving and bringing forth a child called God with us certainly has a secondary meaning, and that is fulfilled in Jesus, who happened to be born of a real virgin. So I think that Matthew is recognizing in here what we usually would call a secondary fulfillment. The first fulfillment happened in Isaiah's own time, in Ahaz's time, as a sign to Ahaz. It had to happen in Ahaz's own days because it was said this would be a sign to Ahaz.
Mm-hmm.
So the first fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14 was Isaiah's own child. Now, some people say, well, wait a minute. Isaiah's child couldn't be a sign because Isaiah's child was not miraculously conceived. So how could that be a sign to Ahaz? But that's understanding the word sign to be a miracle. The word sign doesn't necessarily mean a miraculous sign. It can, but it doesn't have to. What's more, Isaiah mentions his own children as being signs. And it's even quoted in Hebrews, where in chapter 8, Isaiah says, I and the children which the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel. That's chapter 8, verse 18. Isaiah 8:18. So Isaiah he specifically says that his children are signs. And so, of course, his child could be a sign to Ahaz.
And the sign was that before the child grew,
right,
that those kings would be removed. So, I mean, that would be pretty miraculous if in that time frame both of those kings
It would clearly show that the prophecy itself was miraculous.
Sure,
because the prophecy itself could predict such a thing and it would come true. But it would not necessarily mean that the child of Isaiah was a miraculous conception.
Right.
But in applying... go ahead.
Well, the problem I'm still having is nobody was really looking for a second fulfillment to that
prophecy. That's right.
Prophecy.
That's right.
And it's just happened that God used the virgin to bring Christ about. And so Matthew looks back and sees this verse
right,
led by the Holy Spirit, and he ascribes Christ.
A lot of prophecies about Christ, including some that he made himself, were not understood until after their fulfillment. They were understood in retrospect. For example, when Jesus said in John chapter 2, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up again, he was referring to his body, but he didn't say so. And it says in John chapter 2 that after he rose from the dead, his disciples remembered this and apparently understood what he was talking about. So a lot of prophecies are not really understood until they're understood in retrospect. And Matthew does this quite a bit, to tell you the truth. In Matthew's gospel, he'll quote Old Testament passages, which in the Old Testament, they don't sound like they're talking about what he's talking about.
Right.
But, for example, when he says, out of Egypt I've called my son. Now, that's Hosea 11:1. Matthew quotes it in Matthew chapter 2, and he applies it to Jesus as a child coming out of Egypt because his family had fled there to escape from Herod. So, but if you look at Hosea 11:1, it's not a prediction about the Messiah. No one would take it that way. In Hosea 11:1, it says, when Israel was young, I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. In other words, God called Israel out of Egypt. When? In the Exodus. Hosea is not prophesying something. Hosea is remembering something. He's remembering the Exodus. And yet Matthew recognizes that Jesus, as I believe a fulfillment of the type, Israel is a type of Christ. And Isaiah's children are a type of Christ. See, these are the types in the Old Testament, and Christ is the fulfillment of those types. So Matthew sees in retrospect, oh, we didn't know that Isaiah's child was a type of anything. But now we see Jesus is born of a virgin. He is God with us. Clearly, Jesus is the antitype or the fulfillment of the type, which was Isaiah's own son.
Right.
And likewise, when Matthew quotes Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I've called my son, what he's essentially saying is, you know, we didn't know this before, but Israel was a type of Christ, the Messiah. And therefore, this reference in Hosea to God calling Israel out of Egypt, referring back to the Exodus, shows that this was something that God did in Israel, and it served as a type, which is now we see fulfilled in Christ coming out of Egypt. It might seem like a convoluted way of thinking, but it's not. I think the disciples actually had a very consistent approach to these things.
Well, was it a week or so ago that you were talking about the prophets in general and how God, through the prophets, would talk about short-term salvation to their problems, and then after that they would have a long-term salvation approach and how God would ultimately redeem his people.
That's right.
Isaiah passage, that short-term he would redeem them, but long-term there would come one that would be God with us.
That is a pattern. It is a pattern in the prophets, and that's how the apostles clearly understood it.
Hmm.
Because they saw things that had a fulfillment, or we could say at least a partial fulfillment,
right,
in the short term of the prophet's own day, or at least it fulfilled in Old Testament times. But then they saw that the same principle was at work, that there was a secondary application of it that really occurred in Christ's case. So that when we say that Jesus fulfilled a lot of Old Testament prophecy, it doesn't mean that there were 300 Old Testament prophecies which the rabbis could read and say, oh, this is what the Messiah will be like. It's more that in retrospect, prophecies that were about Jesus were recognized to be that after he fulfilled them. And which is another reason, you know, some people say, well, Jesus' fulfillment of prophecy is not a big deal. He was a Jew who knew the scriptures. He could make it happen. But that argument falls flat on several reasons. But one of them is that the prophecies Jesus fulfilled were often prophecies that the Jews weren't expecting to be fulfilled by the Messiah. It's only after he did so that it was seen that this is a valid fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. All right, well, again, that gives me a lot to think about, and I really appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
All right.
Really enjoy your program a lot.
God bless you, Ben. Good hearing
all
you.
Right, yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, we're going to hear next from Dean from Pacific Grove, California, who I've met a couple times at our meetings, but not recently. Hi, Dean.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I miss coming out to it. It's just I get so busy on Mondays, and I'm so involved with other things.
Excuses.
I know, huh? Hey, a question I have regarding the Transfiguration and the verses leading up to it.
Yeah.
And in 1628.
Yeah, where he says
this
generation will not pass. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And then it says that some of them wouldn't taste death who were standing there. Now, and then it says 6 days later, and people say that that's talking about the Transfiguration.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree or disagree on that view of it? Because I wondered, I just struck me recently that who is he speaking to that wouldn't taste death if it was the Transfiguration in a six-day period?
No one tasted death in 6 days then, yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was just something
that's
kind of like, well, why do people say that, you know, and they stick so boldly on that way he was speaking of the Transfiguration, yet it makes
sense. Let me bring our listeners up to speed to where you are already.
Okay.
And that is that at the end of Matthew chapter 16 in verse 28, Jesus said to his disciples, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Okay? And then the next thing you read about is the Transfiguration, which was 6 days or 7 days later. It says after 6 days. I think Luke says about
eight
days. Yeah. And but Matthew and Mark and Luke all record that prediction that some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming. And then all three of the Gospels place the Transfiguration next in their narrative, even though a whole week went on between. They don't record anything in between. And so many Christians, in trying to get over what looks like an embarrassing prediction, have said, well, it's predicting the Transfiguration. And when I say an embarrassing prediction, obviously if Jesus said his coming would be within the lifetime of some of them standing there, and he didn't return in that period of time, well, then he missed his prediction. And there are many people, including Bertrand Russell and other atheists, who say that this is a flaw in Jesus, that he, you know, he failed to predict that correctly. My position is, and so is the position of all evangelicals I know of, that Jesus was not predicting his second coming. Now, what was he predicting? It sounds like his second coming. He says, until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. But either he was wrong, or else he wasn't predicting the second coming. He's predicting something else, and the wording sounds similar. Now, the evangelical consensus, for the most part, is that he was talking about the Transfiguration. Now, remember, if he was, then it's very clear that when he spoke of the Son of Man coming in his kingdom, he was not talking about his second coming. He was talking about something else. In this case, by this theory, it was the Transfiguration. And yet there is a problem with it, and you've noted that problem. He said some of you standing here won't taste death before the event he's predicting. And yet this happened a week later, and none of them had died in between. So it's kind of an overstatement. He should have said some of you won't take a bath before you see it or something like that, you know, instead of some of you won't die. And so he sounds like he's referring to something further out than the Transfiguration. Now, there's another consideration.
Now, can you, that's what I was kind of using in my thoughts because of all the different stuff I've studied and the different views is it made a lot of sense to me that they were referring to the destruction of the temple on and 70 AD, the whole thing leading up to 70 AD, because at that time, some of them I don't know how many, but some of them did survive through that period. I know John obviously did, and I don't know who didn't make it that time other than Stephen. I don't know when Peter was crucified. I'm not sure of the dates, but that's how I kind of made the most sense to me.
Well, I tend to take that view also, but there's another view that's intermediate to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the view that it's the Transfiguration, I think is not convincing to me. But the view that it is the that it's the day of Pentecost is another possibility. Mm. The Son of Man coming in his kingdom could be seen as the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. Mm-hmm. And certainly, and one of them had died before that, Judas. But I don't even think that's what he's referring to, and I agree with you. I think he is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and there's a very good reason for saying so. And that is that this idea that some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the coming of the Son of Man sounds almost exactly like another prediction he made later in Matthew 24. Mm-hmm. When he said that you'll see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven with power and great glory in Matthew 24, verse 30. And then in the same chapter, verse 34, he says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." Now, think about it. The statement, "this generation will not pass away before this happens," and the statement, "some of you here won't die before then," it's the same prediction in different words, is it not? And in both cases, he talks about the Son of Man coming in that generation or before some of them have died. Now, in Matthew 24, he seems very clearly to be talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, because the chapter 24 begins with the disciples asking him about the destruction of Jerusalem. He predicts the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24, verses 1 and 2. In Matthew 24, verse 3, they ask him when that will be, and presumably he answers their question. And that's what Matthew 24 is about. And so he predicts the destruction of Jerusalem and says, this generation will not pass before these things occur. Now, was he right? Of course he was right. It happened exactly 40 years after he predicted it, one generation. So I believe that that's what he was predicting. Of course, the issue that people have with that is that it sounds like he's talking about his actual second coming. Mm-hmm. And yet we have to remember that the prophets spoke of God coming in many ways other than literal. Mm-hmm. They spoke of God, when a special blessing came to Israel, they said God came or God visited Israel. When a special judgment came upon Israel, it was said that God came or God visited. The idea of God coming in the Old Testament prophets was very, very frequently not literal. It was not about God appearing visibly. It was about God doing something in their midst, whether blessing or judging, which was seen to be, a manifestation of God's involvement there and God's presence. And so they say God visited us or God came. And when Jesus said, the Son of Man is going to come and there's going to be this judgment, many people feel that the judgment that God brought on Jerusalem in AD 70 is what he was predicting. And it is possible. It is entirely possible. I think it fits better than the other theories. And those who want to insist, no, he said it's the Son of Man coming, it must be the second coming, well, then they have no room to say it's the Transfiguration.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Transfiguration wasn't the second coming. What I'm saying is that all evangelicals, whether they think it's the Transfiguration, or whether they think it's Pentecost, or whether they think it's the destruction of Jerusalem, all of them believe that it's not the literal second coming, even though the wording sounds like it. So all evangelicals have to acknowledge that there are passages that sound like they're talking about the second coming, but they're talking about something else. Mm-hmm. And by the way, since Jesus made this prediction that you brought up in Matthew 16:28, and he made essentially the very same prediction, Matthew 24,
mm-hmm.
it can't be referring to the Mount of Transfiguration, because
right.
Matthew 24 was after that, and he made the
That's
prediction
right.
then, too.
Good sense. One last thing, you brought it up with about this generation will not pass. How do they explain away the term used, this generation, and make it a future generation in kind of end times and eschatology
yeah.
stuff?
Well, there's two ways.
Even in chapter 23, he speaks to them, the Pharisees speaking about that generation, and he clearly was speaking to them.
Yeah. Well, the term "this generation" is used by Jesus five or six times in the Gospel of Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
In all the other instances besides Matthew 24:34, in all the instances, he's talking clearly about his own people living at his own time, his own generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come to Matthew 24:34, where he says, this generation will not pass. That's not the first time he's used the expression, this generation. It's about the fifth or sixth time he's used it in Matthew.
Right.
And all the other times he's talking about his own generation. And he certainly, his disciples would have every reason to believe that he's talking about his own generation when he says, this generation will not pass. Especially since he had already told them the same thing in different words. When he said, some of you tasting here won't see death
right.
until this happens. So, I mean, the simplest way to understand it is the simplest way. He's talking about his generation. Now, you ask how people take it to be a later generation. There's two things that dispensationalists do who like to put all this off to the end of the world. One is they say the word generation means a race of people. The word genea, generation in the Greek, can mean a race or a family of people.
Mm-hmm.
The lexicons that I have looked at usually put that as a secondary meaning, but it is a legitimate meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people think that he's talking about this race will not pass. And then they want to make it to be the Jewish race or maybe the race of Christians or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there's nothing in Matthew 24 to point to any race at all.
Mm-hmm.
For him to say this race will not pass, to decide what race he's talking about is fairly speculative, because he doesn't really mention anything about races in this passage at all.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, what the disciples have asked him in that chapter is, when will this happen? Now, if he says, don't worry, this race won't pass away before it happens, well, he has not answered their question. But if he says, this generation will not pass away before it happens, he has answered their question, and we might expect him to do so. So, in other words, if it's this race, he has told them nothing about what they asked. He's given them no chronological information at all.
Right.
But if he says this generation, meaning the contemporaries, which is what he means in all the other cases when he says this generation in the book of Matthew, well,
right.
then he has told them something about the timing, which is exactly what their question was about. Now, there's another thing people do, and they make it out to not be this generation, but essentially that generation will not pass, meaning that Jesus was talking about a future generation, in the end of the world. And the way they try to connect that, it's rather ingenious, but it's not valid. You know, before Jesus says this generation will not pass, he actually says, from the fig tree learn this lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and it puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. Now, they say this is connected to the fig tree. He talks about the fig tree when it begins to bloom again after the winter, and in the springtime it puts out tender shoots. He says, when you see that happening, you know that summer is near.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what dispensationalists say is that the fig tree is an image for Israel. And when the long winter of Israel being dead has been the time since the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 until modern times.
Mm-hmm.
And the sending forth of new life, new shoots, the spring growth on the olive tree is the reappearance of Israel as a nation in modern times in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And so they think when Jesus says, you know, when you see these things on the fig tree, know that summer is near, that he is saying when Israel is reestablished in the end of the times, then this generation, that is the generation that sees that, will not perish before all things are fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's very ingenious, but it doesn't work. First of all, if you look at the parallel in Luke 21, when Jesus talks about the fig tree, he says, consider the fig tree and all the trees. When they put out their leaves, you know summer is near. In other words, he's just using a fig tree as an example of any tree. He's not making it a symbol of Israel. He says, consider the fig tree and all the trees. He's making a statement from nature. Secondly, you could even tell by what he says in Matthew that he doesn't mean Israel. He says, when you see a fig tree put out leaves, you know that summer is near. He says, so also, when you see these other things take place, know that it is near, even at the doors.
Right.
So, in other words, he's just using an example from nature. You people know how to tell that summer is coming by looking at the state of the flowering and the fruiting trees. And so also, when you see these other signs I'm talking about, you'll know that what I predict is near.
So it's like he used the color of the sky in the one verse. I don't remember.
Exactly. You're right. In another place, Jesus said, when you see the sky is red in the morning, you know that it's going to be bad weather. And when you see it's red in the evening, you say it's going to be good weather. And he says, you hypocrites, you know how to read the face of the sky, but you can't discern the times
exactly.
that you're in. So the very same kind of statement. He's not making a statement about Israel there. And furthermore, the assumption that he is doing so rests on the claim that Israel is regularly represented as a fig tree in the Old Testament. It never is. You cannot find one place in the Old Testament where a fig tree is without dispute an image for Israel. There are references to vines and fig trees, but they usually mean regular vines and fig trees. And, of course, the Jews who went into captivity in the book of Jeremiah are spoken of as a basket of figs, but that's not the same thing as a fig tree. There's no place in the Old Testament where a fig tree serves as an image of Israel. So it's rather esoteric to say that he expects them to understand the fig tree to be Israel here. And why should he? What he said doesn't apply to Israel. It applies to trees and fruit. And he says, in the same way that you see these things happening, you know that summer is near. So yeah. Also, when you see these other things happening, you know that the coming is near, that I'm predicting.
Well, even you know, the multiple times that Jesus explains in Matthew 24, he's speaking them directly, and he uses "you will see," tells them you over and over and over what they would experience or what they would see. If he was meaning a future thing, I would assume that he would put "and they will see." Yeah, so it was just, you know, and then when the transfiguration thing came up, I'm just going, gosh, that stance doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So
right. That stance that Jesus is predicting the transfiguration does not take into consideration that he made the same prediction again after the transfiguration. So he's obviously talking about something later.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for in detail, as always.
All right. God bless you, Dean.
God bless you as well.
Bye now. Bye-bye. All right, our next caller is Eric from Santa Cruz, and we have a line open for you now at 1-800-438-5090. Eric, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so I'm a relatively new believer, and the biggest stumbling block for my faith is the heavy topic of hell.
Uh-huh.
And then I was reading about annihilationism.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting to me, even though, but, you know, since most people don't believe that, I'm suspect of that, but it just seems to, I'm just confused about, you know, like in John 3:16, which I love, you know, they use the word perish, which means destroyed.
Right.
You know, and then, but then other times, you know, Jesus used the word Hades, and then he used the word Gehenna, which is a temporary place, and it's just real confusing to me because in eternal, you know, condemnations, that idea, it just seems so cruel. It's hard, you know, that's why annihilationism, you know, is comforting, but I don't quite think it's true. I just wanted to know what you thought about that whole mess.
Well, it's a deep subject, and there's a lot of, no pun intended, and there's a lot of different opinions on it. You know, what many people don't realize is that hell, if by hell we mean where the bad people go who are not saved, after the judgment, you know, the eternal fate of the lost, if that's what we mean by hell, it is not spoken of very often in Scripture. It is no doubt spoken of in the book of Revelation as the lake of fire, where after the judgment day, you know, all whose names are not written in the book of life are cast in the lake of fire. But it doesn't say what happens to them after that necessarily. There is a reference to Satan and the false prophet and the beast going into the lake of fire, and it says they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. But later on, when it talks about others going there, it doesn't mention if that's true or not. It may be. I think most people assume that it is. But the point is, outside of the book of Revelation, we have very, very few, if any, references to hell. I think we have them in the story of the sheep and the goats, where Jesus talks about being thrown into eternal punishment prepared for the devil and his angels and so forth.
And the, you know, when Jesus mentions Hades, I thought that was really strange. And then
Hades is not hell. Hades is not hell, but unfortunately, traditionally in the English Bible, it was translated hell, and that was a big mistake because, you know, if Hades is translated hell and if Gehenna is translated hell, then suddenly you have a whole lot of references to hell. But that's only in the English Bible. Jesus used the word Gehenna, and he used the word Hades, and Paul used the word Hades. And Peter, I think, or Paul didn't, but I think other writers in the New Testament did. But the point is that Hades and Gehenna do not mean hell. Hades will be thrown into the lake of fire, according to Revelation chapter 2. death and Hades will be cast into the lake of fire. Now, if the lake of fire is hell, then Hades isn't. And therefore, the traditional translation, translating Hades as hell, was a mistake. In fact, almost all reasonable new translations leave the word Hades untranslated because they know that hell is not the right word for it, and they're not sure what word is. The word Hades simply refers to the place where dead people go, but it does not refer to the place that dead people are forever and ever and ever. It's not what we normally think of a hell. It's more like a holding place, apparently, of the dead after they die, but before the judgment. After the judgment, Hades itself is ended and thrown into the lake of fire. So to translate Hades as hell is a big mistake if we're thinking that hell means the place where the wicked go after the judgment. Now, Gehenna, on the other hand, is often translated hell in the Bible, and it should be left untranslated also, because Gehenna means the Valley of Hinnom. And the Valley of Hinnom was a valley outside to the southeast of Jerusalem, where at one point in Israel's history, apparently, they burned the garbage. And they also threw the corpses of criminals and people there who died in infamy. And there were perpetual fires burning there to keep the place, you know, disinfected and just to keep burning the continual flow of garbage. It's the garbage dump of Jerusalem. It was called the Valley of Hinnom. The word Gehenna means, literally in Greek, Valley of Hinnom. And so when Jesus talked about people needing to beware of being thrown into Gehenna, unfortunately, the King James Version translates that as hell. But that's not what Gehenna means. Gehenna doesn't mean hell. It means the Valley of Hinnom. Now, what does it really mean in the context that Jesus uses it? Well, Jesus seems to be using it the same way Jeremiah did. Jeremiah spoke about the Valley of Hinnom also.
Oh.
And both Jesus and Jeremiah, in their own days, predicted the destruction of Jerusalem by invaders. In Jeremiah's day, it was the Babylonian invaders that were coming. In Jesus' day, it was the Roman invaders that were coming. But Jesus and Jeremiah both prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem and the invasion of the pagans that were going to destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple and slaughter the Jews. And Jeremiah, before Jesus, when he was predicting what the Babylonians would do in destroying Jerusalem, they said that that the Valley of Hinnom will be full of corpses, meaning that the Jews will be slaughtered by the Babylonians and their corpses will be thrown into the dump in the Valley of Hinnom. And that was a way of depicting that they would die an ignominious death. They would not be buried. They wouldn't be given a decent burial. It'll be like a mass grave in Gehenna, because the Babylonians will slaughter so many people. There'll be just so many corpses, they'll just toss them on the fires in Gehenna. Now, Jesus comes along, and he's also predicting that Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, this time by the Romans. And he's warning his generation, saying, if you don't come to me, you're going to be thrown in Gehenna. Now, sadly, the King James translators, who apparently didn't understand how Gehenna was used by Jeremiah and how it was almost certainly being used by Jesus, they just translated Gehenna as hell. And so in our English Bibles, we have lots of references to hell, but most of them are of Gehenna, and a whole lot of them are of Hades. But neither of those words mean hell. I did say that hell is mentioned as the lake of fire in Revelation, and probably as the eternal fire mentioned in Matthew 25 in the story of the sheep and the goats. But apart from those places, there is not really a clear reference to what we could call hell. Hell is not a major subject in the Bible. It is there, but it's not a major subject. Now, you're asking about annihilationism. Annihilation is the idea that once people are thrown into hell at the end of the world, after the judgment, when people are thrown into hell, instead of being tormented forever and ever and ever, day and night, for eternity, their torment will be limited. They will suffer as much as they should. Not everyone has sinned equally. Our criminal justice system acknowledges that justice does not give every criminal the same penalty, because there are great crimes and there are lesser crimes. And likewise, the Old Testament law makes it clear that there are greater crimes and lesser crimes, and not all deserve the same judgment. Even the New Testament does. Jesus talked about those who will be beaten with many stripes and those who will be beaten with few stripes in the judgment. So we can see that the Old and New Testament and simply our own awareness of what justice is, would say that criminals, their crimes don't all deserve the same punishment. And the annihilation view would be that when people are thrown into hell, they will be tormented. They will be punished as long as their crimes warrant. But then they will be snuffed. They will not experience any more torment nor anything else. They will be, they'll disappear. They'll be annihilated. Now, there are some annihilationists that don't allow that there will be any punishment for them at all. That some annihilationists believe that the souls will just be thrown into the lake of fire and they'll just be incinerated instantly. Yeah. Or,
that's,
you know,
what I thought, sorry, that's what I thought worked well with the word perish, that it's like in John 3:16 and stuff.
Right, well, perish.
Destroyed, you know, but.
Well, right, well, someone who's burned at the stake perishes, but a person burned at the stake can last for hours. When Calvin burned Michael Servetus, he burned him over green wood so he'd suffer longer. And I believe Michael Servetus was alive in the flames for like 5 hours or something. So, I mean, the man perished. The man perished, but he perished after much suffering. And so some annihilationists believe that people just perish instantly in the lake of fire, and that's the end of them. Others feel that since not all sinners deserve the same punishment, each will receive a proportionate punishment, and then they'll perish. That is, they will pass from existence. So that is an alternate view. Now, that view has, for at least in the early part of my lifetime, was usually associated with the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventists, which to me gave me reason to not take it very seriously, because obviously Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult, and Seventh-day Adventists may not be a cult, but they're definitely kind of fringe on a lot of their views. So I felt like annihilationism was just a view to be written off without consideration. But in the 1980s, two very important conservative evangelical scholars came out publicly and said they believed in annihilationism, and that was John R.W. Stott, the leading conservative evangelical voice of England, and Clark Pinnock, a very important evangelical apologist of the Bible, you know, a conservative apologist of the Bible in Canada, a professor up there, Clark Pinnock, who I've had the pleasure of having coffee with just in the past couple of years. But these men, I'd known of them for all my life. They're respected evangelicals. And then in the 80s, they came out publicly and said they believe that annihilationism is taught in the Bible, and that belief in the traditional view of eternal torment is based on a misunderstanding of some symbolism in Revelation and so forth. And that surprised me. Now, I have not come over to embrace annihilationism myself, but I certainly have looked into it since those times. I would say that most Christians would be surprised that there is at least as much biblical evidence that would seem to support some form of an annihilationist case as there is that supports the traditional case. The traditional case, we assume there's scores of biblical references to people being tormented forever and ever. There aren't. There's like three or four references to the torments of hell in the Bible, and at least in terms of it being long term. And they are found in parables and in the book of Revelation, which is has a lot of symbolic visions. So some people think that taking that literally is not what we're supposed to do. But that's just that's an in-house debate between Christians on that. And there's a third view about hell too, but I won't have time to go into it right now.
Okay.
All I can say is the annihilationist view actually does have a fair amount of respectability among a lot of evangelical scholars. There's an increasing number of evangelicals who believe that's what the Bible actually teaches. These are not liberals who are denying the Bible or they're not getting soft. They're actually interpreting the Bible very exegetically and saying, wait a minute, this idea of eternal torment was based on a few verses that were probably not really understood properly. And there's all these other verses about perishing and dying. The wages of sin is death. The day you eat of it, you'll surely die. The soul that sins, it shall die, and so forth. And so there's a lot of studies been done on it. A very large book by Edward Fudge came out called The Fire That Consumes, which you might be interested in. It's like 500 pages. It's an exegetical study of all the biblical evidence. And he's a conservative. I'm going to have to run and take another call before I'm out of time, though, here.
Sure. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay, Eric, and be glad to talk to you again in the future.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye now. Okay, we're going to take a call from Joshua from Santa Cruz here. Joshua, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yeah, hi, Steve. How are you?
Good.
So, yeah, I was calling to follow up on the previous conversation regarding the what was called the Second Coming And I was curious because this is a study that I've gotten involved in recently, and I haven't found anything that numbered when Jesus refers to the Son of Man coming on the clouds as that actually being referenced as the second coming. And in my own study, I've recognized, you know, the visits from Jesus being numerous, one in the flesh.
Yeah.
But I thought when he talks to his disciples about returning, that he was talking about his direct resurrection. And at that same time...
Well, you're thinking, and certainly in John 14 and the rest of the Upper Room Discourse, there are references to his coming back to them after his death, meaning and making reference to his resurrection there.
But even with when he is comforting Peter, and not as a teaching to the crowd, but just to Peter directly, Peter tells him that he wants to go with Jesus, and Jesus explains that Peter can't, but that he would be back, you know, for him. And again, I thought that a lot of people had referenced that to the second coming. But then when he did come back after his resurrection, he wanted to make it known to get Peter and let him know that he was back. And I thought that was for two reasons, to let him know, despite the incident with the crow or with the rooster, that he still loved him. And also he told him that he would be back, so he wanted to show him. But then it was interesting also in my study of going into the book of Revelation that it seems that the second coming of Christ, at least from what I've understood before my study, is that kind of also is points to the final days. But when I see them, I see that they're completely separate. Where I kind of, after Jesus' resurrection, the Son of Man coming on the clouds, I thought that was what he had done when he ascended to heaven. And so now he reigns on the throne. And so what he was doing is freeing up the saints and everybody that was in the bosom of Abraham that's referenced back with Lazarus.
Joshua, let me jump in just because we're going to get cut off here. We're going to hear the theme music in about 30 seconds.
Okay.
And you brought up about four different subjects related to the coming of Christ. Let me just make a generic statement in the time we have here. And if you want to call again on another day, we can talk about it more in depth. The expression second coming is not found in the Bible. But I want to make it clear, I do believe there will be a second coming. I believe Jesus is going to come again. I believe in the future second coming. But having said that, we need to be clear that the term coming is used with reference to Christ in a variety of ways in the Scripture. Sometimes I believe it is referring to the second coming, but other times it clearly is not referring to a second coming. And when it is not, it can be referring to his coming back to the disciples after dying, that is, in his resurrection. It can, in some passages, for example, in John 14, refer to him coming to them through his Holy Spirit at Pentecost. It can refer to him coming in judgment, as in A.D. 70, and it can refer to other things. If someone wants to do their own study on this, certainly just get out a concordance and look up the word coming. See how many times it refers to Jesus. And you can do this just in the first three chapters of Revelation if you want, because the seven churches of Asia were told that he would come to them. But most of those churches have been extinct now for hundreds of years. And yet his coming to them certainly must have happened. But it was not a reference to his second coming. What I'm saying is I do believe the second coming is a reality to be anticipated. But I don't believe that every time we find the words coming refer to Jesus, that it's going to be referring to his second coming. And that's all I can say about it right now because I'm out of time. But, Josh, I appreciate your call. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, maybe you're not sure after listening to a program like this, but we do get you thinking, and we'll get you turning back into the Bible. We'll get you studying your Bible again, in case you've kind of given up on that, or maybe you just thought you already know it all. You can keep us on the air or help us do so by writing to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address. You can find a PayPal link if you want it. You can find lots of stuff at our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'm speaking in Orange County tomorrow. Information is at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. We'll talk again Monday. God bless.